Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the movement for Black Lives has never relied on corporate media to get their message out, but the coalition's newly released policy platform does provide an opportunity for journalists, sometimes given to ponder what Black activists are for, to engage those ideas. We'll hear about a vision for Black lives, policy demands for Black power, freedom, and justice from Ashley Woodard Henderson, organizer with Project South and with Concerned Citizens for Justice and part of the Policy Table leadership team of the Movement for Black Lives. Also on the show, when American firms dominate a global market worth more than $70 billion a year, you'd expect to hear about it. Not so with the global arms trade. That's the lead on a recent article by William Hartung. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of, most recently, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We'll ask him how it is that we hear so little about an industry that's so big. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a very brief look back at the week's press. Big media are heralding a federal appeals court ruling striking down a North Carolina law that made it harder to vote. Harder for some, that is. The court noted that the restrictions on things like early voting and same-day registration targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, and indeed came in the wake of the state's request for specific data on voting practices by race, which itself came in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling in Shelby County versus Holder, saying that states with histories of discrimination no longer needed to get federal clearance for such changes. So it's great to see the New York Times, for instance, excoriating North Carolina Republicans' scurrilous attempt to suppress the rising power of Black voters. In a better world, of course, such campaigns would not have enjoyed years of tailwind from media like The Times, rhetorically balancing claims of potential voter fraud with evidence of actual voter suppression. And mindful of the paper's current note that court decisions like this one show the bitter struggle for basic fairness beyond the national spotlight, we'll look for media to report this story out, with follow-up on how, for instance, North Carolina will mitigate the inevitable confusion over the new exceptions, given that there's no funding for public education, as Samantha Lockman notes at Huffington Post. Or on how, as the nation's Ari Berman points out, this ruling poses a challenge to the Supreme Court's Shelby decision, premised on voter suppression as a thing of the past. Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law reminded in testimony at the DNC how, after the 15th Amendment, states like Alabama introduced bans on voting by people convicted of felonies, along with purposefully ill-defined crimes of moral turpitude, in an admitted effort to disenfranchise Black Americans. These rules that prevent many who've served time in prison from ever voting again were also precisely crafted with a goal in mind, and even after the court's recent ruling, they're still achieving it. Media interest in the issue is welcome. We hope they'll remember that their spotlight is most useful where folks are still working in shadow. Finally, when former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg took the stage at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia to tout his nonpartisanship and call for a sane, competent person for president, we saw a celebration of conservative centrism on the floor and, as Molly Neffel noted for Fair.org, in the establishment media, reacting, after all, to a politician who is also a powerful establishment media mogul. You can feel the appreciation in Washington Post writer Jonathan Capehart's assessment of Bloomberg as political pragmatism personified. Capehart notes that Bloomberg was a Democrat who switched to Republican to run for mayor, then switched to independent when he thought about running for president. And he cites with admiration Bloomberg's statement that any successful elected executive knows that real results are more important than partisan battles and that good ideas should take precedence over rigid adherence to any particular political ideology. What results, or ideas exactly, Bloomberg can claim, were of less interest to pundits than a game of who's the better billionaire. Wrote the Washington Post's Chris Saliza, Bloomberg found his mojo when he turned his rhetorical fire on Trump, and man oh man did he go after his fellow New York billionaire. K-Part 2 had cheered how Bloomberg slammed his fellow billionaire for his business practices that hurt real people. As Neffel notes, one of the policies Bloomberg is most proud of, stop and frisk, was overturned by a federal judge precisely because it hurt real people. Likewise, his policies on homelessness, namely eliminating permanent housing assistance programs that led to an 83% increase in the city's homeless families. During his tenure, Bloomberg proposed budget cuts to the fire department, elderly services, libraries, public schools, and recycling programs. And he cut child care and after-school programs for 5 years in a row. New Yorkers know this, though not thanks to Bloomberg's own media empire. Reporters at Bloomberg News are under a longstanding directive to avoid coverage of their boss, which translated into a virtual ban on investigative reporting of the mayor of New York for 12 years. But none of that changes national media's shorthand for the former mayor as a social liberal but a fiscal conservative, a supporter of the arts, and, strangest of all, the billionaire to root for. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The constellation of activists fighting racist police violence, especially visibly in the last few years, has seemed to confound corporate media. Who's really a member of Black Lives Matter? Why isn't there a single leader? What are they for, and why won't they channel their concerns through the electoral political system? Even before the likes of Bill O'Reilly declared that the killings of police officers meant that anti-brutality activists constitute a hate group, media elites have used such questions as reasons to dismiss the movement for Black Lives as not politically serious. The newly released policy platform, A Vision for Black Lives, Policy Demands for Black Power, Freedom, and Justice, calls media's bluff on the idea that they would engage these concerns if only they could see them articulated. But whatever media do or don't do, the platform is designed with bigger purposes in mind. Here to tell us more about it is Ashley Woodard Henderson. Ashley is part of the Policy Table leadership team of the Movement for Black Lives. She's a regional organizer with Project South and with Concerned Citizens for Justice. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ashley Woodard Henderson.
Hey, thank you.
What is this platform? Tell us about what went into it and what it does.
Sure. And thank you again for having us on so that we could talk about this really transformative document that folks from all over the country and internationally have had conversations about for over a year now. We really created the platform, the Vision for Black Lives, for three key reasons. One being to articulate and elevate a shared set of priorities that reflect the ongoing work of our people and serve as a tool for groups and individuals that are organizing for dignity and power of Black people in the U.S. and abroad. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we were advancing a radical but really clear vision of the world that we want for our people, and not just for reforms that might be Band-Aids on the gaping wounds that our communities are facing.
Right.
We think that this platform really lays out steps that we can take to get us to the liberated communities that we want and that we're trying to build. We're trying to transform these communities. We're trying to transform how policy looks in the 21st century. And we do not want, you know, a tweaking of these existing systems or policy changes that don't address the root causes of the issues that we're facing. And then finally, we really wanted to make sure that we were intervening in the current political moment with an agenda that resists state and corporate power and increases the criminalization and surveillance of our people. We're seeing that happen dramatically across the United States. And we recognize that it's going to take a grassroots movement to save us, not just individual political parties or candidates. About a year and some change ago, back in July of 2015, we had a big Movement for Black Lives National convening that you and many of your listeners probably will remember. And we had about 2,000 Black people from all over the world show up. And it was really powerful because we asked if folks wanted to prioritize organizing and base building, if they wanted to prioritize direct action, political education, or talking about policy, creating and fighting for policy change. And what we were told by an overwhelming majority of those people is that they wanted us to prioritize all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created some strategy sessions within the convening for folks to talk about the different issue areas that they wanted for us to be highlighting and lifting as we continued to collectively build, not individually or in silos or by individual organizations, but collectively as a united front build in this transformative movement. And so there was about 200-400 people in the policy strategy session, and they started the process of building the information that is now in this document. You know, over 30 organizations participated in the initial crafting of it, and I believe we're at 60 to 80 organizations have signed on to it since. Thousands of people are signing on to endorse it. And really what we did as a leadership team and then as the full policy table was synthesize all the information that we had heard from people at the convening that our individual organizations were working on the ground, either on the local, state, or federal levels, and then look for any gaping holes that we had missed that people were already doing on the ground.
Right.
We by no means think that this policy platform is going to be the one path to liberation, but we definitely believe that it is a strong, holistic first step, and we're looking forward to continuing to be engaged with communities as people use this as a tool to fight for really transformative change in their communities, and where we've left things out, create even newer documents that are uplifting transformative policies that can be modeled in other communities.
Well, and one of the things that is so powerful about it is the way that it uplifts existing organizations. It's not about making something new or reinventing the wheel. I think that's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. We clearly don't want to be alone in this work, and we don't have to be. And I think the Movement for Black Lives and as a whole, and the policy table in particular, is a manifestation of that desire that, you know, Project South and the Southern Movement Assembly say that we're stronger together, and it's not just a slogan, it is a fundamental fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing that manifested in the Movement for Black Lives and the policy table and the vision for Black Lives. It would not have been the same document had there not been activists and organizers and lawyers and economists and human rights activists and youth, immigrants, like all these different communities of people that were represented by the organizations coming together, representing thousands of Black people across the U.S. and for some of us internationally, to define and articulate a comprehensive visionary agenda. I think that we have been encouraging more and more people to see themselves as the Movement for Black Lives, right? Like we are, mm-hmm. we have never been trying to create something new. And in fact, this very platform is a manifestation of ongoing work that's been happening in the Black radical tradition and the Black liberation struggle before many of us were even born, right? It builds on the legacy of the Black radical tradition, including the work of the Black Panther Party, the Black Radical Congress, the Black Consciousness Movement out of South Africa, many, many others. And we see ourselves in the tradition of the freedom fighters that came before us.
Let me just ask you finally, I saw in one report the platform described as a pivot away from focusing on racist policing. It's not really a pivot away from. It seems to me to be a broadening, you know, a connection of that phenomenon, which was so salient and the focus for many people's energy and concern, just connecting it to the other things that it's naturally connected to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have always said that state violence was bigger than just police murdering Black people.
Right.
However, we cannot end state-sanctioned violence without dealing with policing in the United States. So obviously, ending the war on Black people, stopping the killing of Black people, especially at the hands of police and law enforcement, is critical to this platform. But we also recognize that even if we stop police brutality tomorrow, there would still be issues that plagued our communities. It's why we also lift up a call for reparations. It's why we also lift up divestment from the institutions that criminalize, cage, and harm Black people, and an investment in the education, health, and safety of Black people. It's why we call for economic justice for all and a reconstruction of the economy to ensure our communities have collective ownership and not merely access. It's why we ask for community control of the laws, institutions, and police that most impact us. And in fact, even stronger than asking it, we demand it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it's why we think that it's so important for there to also be a push for independent Black political power and Black self-determination in all areas of society. And so, again, you know, absolutely, we are still about the work of ending police brutality and sanctioned violence in our communities at the hands of law enforcement. But we know that we need a more holistic program to be able to actually see liberation for Black people in our lifetime. And so there's about 40 policy demands in the document. Folks can find it at policy.m4bl.org. And we are encouraging people to engage with it and see it as theirs. It's a tool for them to be able to take to their grassroots communities and fight for justice for Black people with some concrete transformative demands that we hope will actually change the material conditions of Black people in transformative and liberatory ways, and so much that we won't have to tear them down later. Like, that was actually a really critical piece for us in developing these policies, is that it wouldn't be things that harmed other people and that it would transform the way that Black people are treated and increase our ability to thrive and live in our full dignity and humanity in the United States.
We've been speaking with Ashley Woodard Henderson from Project South and Concerned Citizens for Justice. Again, you can find the policy platform of the Movement for Black Lives online at policy.m4bl.org. Ashley Woodard Henderson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
We appreciate you for having us.
American media love the rich. Besides constant, assiduous attention to the things they buy and eat and wear, we see lists of the richest people alongside numbers indicating what we straightforwardly refer to as their worth. Of less interest is how the rich got and stay that way. And the same holds true for corporations, which of course are a big part of how rich people got and stay that way. Success is success, after all. And for all the tales of a muckraking media, our guest's experience suggests that when it comes to one of the most stupendously successful U.S. industries, the press corps don't seem all that eager to look behind the curtain. William Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and a senior advisor to the Security Assistance Monitor. He's a regular contributor at TomDispatch.com, for which his most recent piece is called "There's No Business Like the Arms Business. Weapons Are Us, But You'd Never Know It." He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, William Hartung.
Thanks for having me.
Well, some listeners may have seen this Lisa Rhine piece in the Washington Post. Recently, it was about how costs for some Defense Department program to maintain vehicles for Afghanistan's military have doubled to hundreds of millions of dollars because of some Keystone Cops kind of failures in oversight. And these are costs, of course, that taxpayers will bear. We hear these kinds of stories sometimes. Some listeners might remember the $640 toilet seat that the Pentagon bought. And we should hear these stories. But those kinds of stories might leave the impression not only that things usually go right, but that things going right is cause for celebration. And so it's very interesting that the focus of your latest piece is on how news media approach the arms industry on a regular day, if you will, and whether that coverage is really commensurate with the power of the industry. What is your sense of that?
Well, I mean, it's a $70 billion industry, and the U.S. dominates it year after year. And a lot of these things, of course, are being used in places like Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, where a lot of groups think they've committed war crimes. So you would think this would be subject ripe for regular coverage. But what usually happens is the government puts out some statistics every year about who ranks where in the global arms trade. The Times, Washington Post, maybe AP do a story. And other than episodic little mentions in other stories, that's usually it, which is quite extraordinary given the impact that the trade has, not just economically, but on people's lives.
Well, maybe there's the rub. I mean, in some sense, it seems that it is drawing a direct connection between the impact on people's lives and the industry that maybe journalists on some level don't want to do. You know, I mean, in a way, there's a tremendous pretense, you know, that you talk about in the piece, that you sort of act as though it doesn't affect your ideas about policy, the fact that the country and particular corporations make so much money from selling bombs. You know, how can we not connect that to how hard we fight for diplomatic measures? I mean, those ties are crucial, it would seem, to make.
Yeah, and there's a whole ideology about the arms trade when it is discussed at all, which is that somehow we're helping people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're creating stability, and the arms are less likely to be used, and countries like Iran will do less nefarious things if we arm the Saudis. And it's been quite the opposite. I mean, Saudi Arabia has been killing civilians, using cluster bombs, fighting one of the most egregious wars in Yemen that we've seen in a long, long time. So it's far from stability, but what it is a steady source of income for companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and they're kind of part of the push for making these things happen, usually hand in glove with the government.
Well, I remember you were saying years ago that part of what sustains the status quo, despite, you know, the occasional calls that we do hear to cut military spending or to cut back on weapons programs that seem to be duds, you know, but part of the issue is the way the benefits are so distributed throughout, not to put too fine a point on it, throughout congressional districts, you know, so that it's not so simple as to simply say we should stop making this certain kind of fighter plane because the making of it is so widely distributed throughout the country.
Well, that sort of political engineering is done on purpose, and it's done to kind of weave these programs into the economy in such a way that a lot of people will be affected, a lot of members' districts and so forth. For arms sales, tank sales to Saudi Arabia are helping keep plants in Ohio and Michigan running. A new sale to Kuwait will help Boeing keep a plant going in Missouri. So these are important states. Some of them are swing states, and you wouldn't likely see a president hold back on this kind of thing in an election year, although Obama has been a little slow on the sale to Kuwait. So I don't know if common sense has interceded or if it's a bureaucratic issue.
But it does make those ties hard to trace, I think, for sort of the layperson to try to figure out why is it not so simple to say, let's just stop making, you know, this certain fighter plane that it seems like we're never going to use again. Well, the tendrils of it reach quite far.
Yeah, we'd have to break through the current Congress and actually invest in some things that the country needs in order to create alternative jobs. And with Congress not willing to make public investments, then it's much harder to get around that dependency on arms exports and military spending.
Well, let me ask you about Obama's particular legacy on this. Is something you also talk about in the piece. Where does he fit in terms of arms sales globally for the U.S.?
Well, the Obama administration has brokered more big arms sales than any administration since World War II. It's sort of neck and neck with Richard Nixon during the OPEC oil crisis when they were trying to recycle petrodollars by selling as much as they could to the Middle East. So it's partly they're pushing exports in general. It's partly that he wants to keep fewer boots on the ground than Bush did, and therefore he's using arms and training and special forces as an alternative way to intervene. So he's got a couple rationales, and you know, you'll see it periodically. When the Iran nuclear deal happened, he had a meeting at Camp David to try to get the Gulf Cooperation Council on board, and he said the U.S. would reassure them. And that reassurance came in the form of all kinds of arms sales. So it's used as a diplomatic tool as well.
Well, you note also in the piece that there have been, it's not just a matter of amount, but that certain restrictions and processes of scrutiny that were in place have been loosened, have they not, under Obama?
Yes. This was a longstanding goal of industry, and they couldn't get it through for probably a couple of decades. But what they've done is, for one thing, they've taken things that were on what's called the munitions list. Obviously, weapons have to be licensed by the State Department, and they've moved a bunch of those to the Commerce Department's jurisdiction. Commerce is mostly involved in pushing exports, not keeping track of things like, are they going to human rights abusers? so that alone, I think we'll see the impacts going forward to the future, that it'll be easier for dictators or human rights abusers or countries that are on the terrorist list by the United States to find roundabout ways to get their hands on U.S. arms components and U.S. weapons.
Well, finally, media sort of whistled past what could have been a usefully uncomfortable moment when the head of CBS, Les Moonves, said Donald Trump was bad for the country but good for CBS. You know, it seems like dealing with the fact that companies can profit from things that we might consider to be or do consider to be social ills, we just, as journalists, I mean, don't you think that journalists simply have to dig into that? It seems as though it's kind of underestimating your audience to think that they can't handle the truth of the various motivations that that governments and corporations use when they make choices.
Absolutely. And, you know, you don't see a lot of discussion of the consequences and the connection to that the arms are coming from the United States. So unless you read around in many different sources, you don't get the full picture of what a devastating trade this in and responsibility of our government and our corporations for keeping it running. And, you know, you'll see, in a book by a mainstream journalist, I'll get into some of this, but it rarely makes it into the newspaper. So then you have to go to the independent press or some of the specialized publications, and the average citizen doesn't have the time to do that. So it's just not on the public agenda the way it should be. And regular press coverage would help make that happen.
We've been speaking with William Hartung of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His most recent book is Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. The article, There's No Business Like the Arms Business, Weapons Are Us, But You'd Never Know It, can be found on tomdispatch.com. William Hartung, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yes, thanks for having me again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.